Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is William Knight, 19 years of career experience, Tillerman on Truck 21 with DeKalb County Fire Rescue. Becoming a firefighter wasn't on William's mind. It wasn't until high school where he began to think more and more of the fire service. When he was sure, he obtained his EMT and began applying and testing everywhere he could until DeKalb contacted him for a position. William isn't perfect and tries every single day to not only perfect his skills at firefighting, but also within himself and in life. And that's where I truly hope the listeners can pick up a few gems being dropped in the conversation. With that, I present William Knight.
I'm William Knight. I work for DeKalb County Fire Rescue. I've been a driver operator there for a while. In total, I've worked there for 19 years now. And I'm a DO on Truck 21, so I'm typically the tillerman for my shift. Yeah.
Okay. And if you would let the guests know, was the fire service always something you wanted to do? Was it a calling? Are you a generational firefighter?
No, I'm the first and probably the last in line. My family never really had any involvement. My grandfather used to hang out at a firehouse when he was a kid, just as a kid. You know, every kid likes fire trucks. So, but that was pretty much it. My dad took me to Gwinnett County Station 2 when I was a kid, which was just a little metal shop building type station probably in the 80s. And that was pretty cool. I don't remember much else about it other than going there. I don't know if that triggered anything. I don't think I really felt like that's what I wanted to do until I got into high school. And it just kind of hit me. So it was just one of those things that kind of you just start feeling it. There wasn't a moment or anything where that was the thing and the time and the place that I knew it was going to happen. But that's when I started wanting to do it. And I got into some other stuff coming out of high school, wanted to play in bands and music, things like that. Started college, but never finished it. All along, I was still looking at the fire service. And I went in order to make myself more marketable and let some speeding tickets kind of cook off a little bit, I went and got EMT first. And then that also led me right into DeKalb County. I was an EMT for about a year before I got on with DeKalb. And they were the first ones that, gave me a shot. And I'm lucky that it was them. There were a lot of other departments that I was applying to. I just wanted to be a fireman. I didn't know anything about the departments. I lived in Gwinnett County, a neighboring county to DeKalb, in Metro Atlanta. And that's where I wanted to work because I knew the county. I knew people there. And I just ended up getting picked up by DeKalb first. As it would turn out, that's the best place I could have gone in Atlanta. I think. I'm a little bit biased, but I think DeKalb County is the best place to be a fireman in Metro Atlanta.
Okay. So you mentioned you applied any and everywhere, but DeKalb was the first to respond back and bring you aboard. So with that being said, did you have to do any sort of academy of recruit school?
Sure. Yeah. Like everybody that has nothing, I had EMT only. So all I had to do was the fire side of things and then a quick little, like, here's our protocols and that kind of stuff for people that are already EMTs. So my academy was just the firefighter side of it pretty much. And then a few weeks at headquarters to get everything kind of locked in. So yeah, it was about 6 months in recruit school for me. And then I hit the field in December of 2006.
Okay. And what was your first assignment?
I was assigned to Engine 8, which at the time was a pretty slow engine in a pretty affluent area. And nowadays, it's not that. It's a very busy engine in an affluent area that also has a bordering piece of its territory that's not as nice. And so they are very busy on med calls, not so much fires. But that's where I started, was on an engine company. And I did a lot of my probationary time and my early couple of years were all on engines. And it wasn't until around 2011, 2010, 2011, somewhere in there, that I got to a house that had a truck that I was senior enough to do some tailboard time on. And so that's when I started doing truck work and started digging into it and learning it, going to classes and trying to pick up the knowledge. And I've been on truck companies for most of my time since then. Little stints on some engines here and there. When I first made driver, I was on an engine. But yeah, truck work is, that's where my heart lies.
Okay. You mentioned that you started taking classes. Back then, was there such things as, these fire conferences that are all over where you can go and take specific classes to better yourself?
I'm sure there were around the country, but I probably wasn't in tune with most of them. FDIC's been around forever, so that existed. But the Metro Atlanta Firefighters Conference, MAFC, it's been going for quite a while, probably almost all of my career. And I've been going to it for as long as I knew about it. So I think I got in on the second or third year that it started as a student. And I've been going every year ever since, haven't missed one. And so yeah, it's been, when I first started going, I was taking engine classes because that's what I was on. And then when I got to a double company and I realized that there was a whole other side of this that I probably need to get some stuff on, I started taking truck classes, and that was huge. I started running into instructors from all over the country, and some of the guys that I still look at as mentors and foundational instructors that made a huge difference in my trajectory, my career path, and the things that I do still to this day, all came from that conference from a couple of years right when I first started hitting the truck side of the fire service.
Okay. You mentioned the word mentors, mentorship. How important is it for any new person coming in, or hell, just anybody that actually wants to get better at the job to try to find, whether that individual knows or not, a mentor, someone they can bounce ideas and get questions off of?
It's pretty critical. I think most people know that. It's fairly common sense if you think about it, that if you try and go through anything major in life by yourself, you're missing out on the potential for growth, learning, and things like that, where instead of having to do it all yourself, learn it all yourself, make all the mistakes yourself, if you have somebody that has done that stuff before or is right there in that same role as you, they can guide you. It can save you a lot of time, effort, heartbreak, all those things. And it's not just professional, it's personal as well. I think a lot of us on the instructor side, we have had mentors and we try to also be mentors when the opportunity is available. But the last page in my slideshow and a lot of others, I didn't come up with it. I started copying other people, and it's become a kind of a common thing, is to show a mentor slide. It's just a list of guys that have made an impact on your career. And I show that every single class that I teach, whether it's in my department, outside my department, it's the same slide. And it's just a list of guys and girls who have made a major impact on me. And I can point to the things and what they've done for me. And it's, like I said, it's sometimes it's personal, sometimes it's professional, but it's always impactful. And I can call pretty much all of those people up right now, or text them and say, "Hey, I got this thing, and I can lean on them." And if you don't have that, I don't know what you do. If you don't have that, I don't know how you go through anything, especially in the fire service, just by yourself floating around like that. I think naturally you have mentors, whether you intentionally seek them out or there's a formal process or something like that. I think most people gravitate towards people who have some idea of what they're doing, when especially when they're learning something new, they kind of find the person that they can lean on for that. There's very few lone wolves that just do everything by themselves for their entire career. And I don't imagine those people have nearly the same kind of career as people who have mentors.
Okay. With that, what is your take now for individuals who don't like to or don't want to get outside of their own organization to see what's out there? And I say that because right now, DeKalb is a very busy department, lots of fire duty. But getting outside and learning something new, whether you bring it to your department or not, or you implement it, it's still really good to see different ways to do things. So what's your take on outside training?
I love it. Not everybody has to do it. You know, sometimes outside training is doesn't have as much context for your department. If you have a very insular department, some of the bigger, more traditional departments that are really, really steeped in history, tradition, and their own culture, some of the stuff that you go out and learn may not have as much practical application, but maybe you figure out how to apply the stuff that you do. Better or different. I think even for the guys that are in those kinds of departments, I think most of their people that do find their way outside recognize that there's a big benefit to it. The LA, the New York, the Chicago, those guys, when they get out and they start seeing how other people do stuff and they start interacting with other guys, not just on the internet, but like in classes and at conferences and stuff. They start to realize that there's a lot of stuff that's the same across the US, and then there's a lot of stuff that's way different. And sometimes you don't know what piece of the puzzle you've missed out on all along the way because your department just doesn't look outside. And occasionally that can make a difference for an entire organization, even one that big, but it may happen very slow. It may happen a couple guys at a time. It may happen one firehouse at a time. But most of those guys will tell you, like, once they go out and they see some stuff and they train with some people and they bring it back to their firehouse, usually it's a positive. Usually it's if you're the right kind of person and you present it the right kind of way, it's usually met with positivity and not negativity. And if it is met with negativity, you know, whatever, you can, who cares about what those people think?
Okay. At what point in your career did you start? It's a two-part question. At what point in your career did you start to decide to move up the ranks and why?
So when I was a rookie, it was expected that at some point within that year to 2 year mark, you were probably going to start learning to drive an engine, that you were going to start working on your engine operator stuff. And that's your driving hours, your road hours, your cone course stuff, and then learning all the friction loss and pumping skills and all of that. You're going to start working on that after a year or two. And that was just culturally the expectation, no requirement, but and it also did not it was not required to make rank at the time.
Okay.
So it was one of those things where some people would just want to ride tailboard forever and they could, but they would never move up at that point. But they didn't want the extra responsibility and they loved what they were doing. But at some point you'd get the pressure put on you to seek that additional knowledge, training, and responsibility, just so that you could do your part, so that when other people are getting sent off to go fill in and drive an engine somewhere, you know, and you're just sitting here for years riding tailboard with no responsibility, and other guys are getting hammered, it's kind of expected. Hey, chip in and help out your guys, your own crew, so that they're not always the ones getting sent off. That's kind of the mindset behind moving up. Then it was be a team player and think of the other guys. And so that's when I started doing that, was about that time, about the 2 year mark, I guess. And then after that, with my department at the time, you had several promotions that were simply you get the right classes and the time and grade, and it was an automatic promotion. We didn't have a tested driver's position until 2017. I mean, we'd had one before I came on and it got phased out, but in 2017 they brought it back. And so I took that first test when they brought it back, along with 140 other people, and they made 130 something drivers. And so that's when I promoted. But I moved up in the ranks as it became pretty clear that that was the next step. And that it was part of being an asset to the team. So I started working on riding seat and getting acting officer stuff when I had the maturity level to do that. When my officers supported me doing that, and they said, "Yeah, it's about time you should go do this so that you can help out." I wasn't really asking to do it, and they were telling me no. It was just kind of one of those things that just happened where it was like, "I think it's time." And they're like, "Yeah, I think it's time." So that's how that happened. But it was many years into my career before I started riding seat. Probably six or 7 years before I was really riding seat. I was in no rush. So, yeah.
Do you see any issues with individuals who move up like super fast? Like within 2 or 3 years, they're going from firefighter to company officer. Do you see any pros and cons to that? Just your opinion.
Yeah. So in DeKalb, that's not a possibility to move up that quickly. You can barely, it takes 2 years to go from firefighter to the next rank up for us as senior firefighter now. So it takes 2 years to do that. So nobody can move up. And then after that, all the moves are fairly spaced out, with time and grade requirements. So you could have a captain in something like 7, 6, 7 years, something like that, potentially, if everything hit just right. And all the time happened, and they had a test right when you made the time for each of those spots. It'd be quite difficult, but it could happen and has happened in the past. But I've seen people move up really quickly at my part-time department, which is a semi-rural, semi-suburban department, further out, about an hour east of Atlanta. And there, people move up very quickly out of necessity. Their what do you call it? Their matrix is different. It requires a lot of classes early on, and there's not as much opportunity for spending time at a certain rank and developing your skills and your experience. There's just not the call volume, not the types of calls, nor the numbers of calls for people to develop experience. So if you sat them in a role long enough to develop experience, they'd spend half their career in that one spot just out of necessity. You wouldn't have the call volume and the exposure to the types of calls to develop that the same experience as you would in a busier department. So people do move up faster than you would want them to in other departments. And as a result, you do end up with some immaturity, you end up with some inexperience. And of course, that plays out in different aspects of a department. It just, in some departments, it's unavoidable. You have positions that have to be filled, and there's nothing you can do about the lack of call volume, the lack of fires. You can try to train some of that. You can try to replace it with other aspects, but it's very difficult to replace all of the things that come from experience with just training. Their training has no experiential context. And that's very hard to replace without people running the calls and spending the time in a role. So, yeah, I see some downsides to it for sure in my other department. And occasionally in DeKalb, we get people that move up too fast. Mostly people move up too far. It could take them forever to move up to a certain point, but at some point, a lot of people exceed their competence. They're promoted to that old adage, I forget how it goes, but people are promoted right to the limits of their competence. And that's what I see happen. And that happens in every organization. It's not unique to DeKalb, but that's a pretty common thing, more so than people promoting too early, is people promoting past their level of competence and then nobody ever fixing that. Their competence doesn't come up to meet it, and their rank doesn't go down to match. So they just kind of languish in this spot in the middle where they screw everything up for people. And there's nothing that gets done. So I see that. That's pretty common in a large organization. You're going to have that.
And but I like the way you put that, the way you put that in perspective, because that's definitely true. And it's sad. What I don't like about the fire service, granted, I don't really know how other industries work, but the business industry, I kind of see it more where if you have a CEO that's not performing how they should. The company's not making the revenue. After a while, that person's replaced. Where with the fire service, it's like if they got time and grade, or the organization can know this person's a problem, and they just tend to just sweep it under the rug.
Yeah, some of that is just the nature of government. A lot of jobs are more difficult to get rid of in government, especially in the middle areas. When people are probationary, some organizations are really good at filtering them out in that time. And then when people get up to all the way up to the level of being appointed, and there's somebody who has the ability to hire and fire appointed positions easily, then you can see some turnover, like fire chiefs. Fire chiefs, if they don't perform or their department suffers or whatever, they're gone. That's pretty common for a city or a county or whatever organization to cycle a fire chief out because they're not getting it done. That happens. But in that middle area of just the firefighter ranks, the company officers, and even chief officers, that area, I see all over the country a lot of departments where people just kind of get there. And everybody knows they're not great. And they could straight up suck. And there's just nobody likes to demote people. I think demotion doesn't happen often enough, at least in the fire service.
That's a fact.
Yeah. And it's
That's
because it's probably mostly because it's government and things work differently in government. You have a lot of protective processes in a lot of organizations where even if you want to demote somebody, there's a lot more required to do it. The process is much more difficult. Sometimes that works out great for an employee, and sometimes it works out terrible for an organization. So,
Yes, definitely. Okay. Your personal opinion, what does the term or what does aggressive mean to you?
I don't know anymore. I don't. I think aggressive is not a, it's not a, it has no positive or negative to me. It's just kind of a neutral word that gets thrown around a lot. So it's not, it's kind of lost its meaning at this point. It gets used so much now. In my early days, back when I started, it was used as like almost like a counterculture mantra. At the time, there was, and in some places there still is, a pretty heavy safety dominant culture in some organizations. And in order to resist that, there was this overreaction, or maybe not overreaction, but there was a reaction counter to that, where everybody was who was of a better mindset used the word aggressive to describe how they wanted the fire service to be. And it wasn't a bad thing, but it just got used so much that now it just gets thrown around. And I think it's kind of lost its meaning through overuse. So I don't know. I mean, aggressive, it's in the dictionary, but as far as the fire service context, I'm not sure that it has a really strong, useful meaning as much as it used to. I'm sure there are ways to describe what people want aggressive to mean in other ways that might be a little more intelligent at this point or a little more articulate. But I think aggressive's been overused a little too aggressively.
Okay. If I were to say, and granted, I've never been to DeKalb, I've never rode with y'all, but through social media, through the companies I follow, what would it mean to you if I said the cab is an aggressive department?
Yeah, I think I understand your meaning. I'm not
Okay.
saying that it's that the word doesn't apply. I think in how it's used in most of the fire service, especially the social media aspect of it, it gets used a lot to the point where it loses some of that effect. Like you want aggressive to feel how it should feel, and I don't think it feels as good as it used to, because number one, the culture has improved a lot nationwide, so there's a lot less of the safety first mindset, a lot more of the guys who are pushing the right kind of mindset for the right reasons. And so yeah, DeKalb is an aggressive department, as most people would use that word. I think it just means that we're just doing our job. I think there's a lot of departments that are just they're doing their job. Our job is to take care of the citizens. And to me, that's nothing extra. If you call it aggressive, okay, cool. Then, but that's the baseline. For me, that's exactly what I want a department to do. I want the department that covers my house to be that way. If you call it aggressive, good. That's fine. If that's what you want to name it, I just want people to be good firemen, to love the job a little bit, and really care that they're doing a good job. I don't think that's aggressive. I think that's normal. To me, that should be the norm. And anything below that doesn't meet the standard.
Love that. Okay. Leadership, whether company officer or chief officer, what does leadership mean to you?
Oh, dude, that's a harder one. I don't ever know how to answer this one. I hear it at conferences and classes. They ask, what is leadership? What's a leader? I don't know, man. I'm not steeped in the leadership education and stuff like that. I know a leader when I see them, and it's hard. That's a really, really subjective, hard to define thing, dependent on who you're asking.
All right, well, I'll rephrase it then. Do you ride the seat sometimes? Do you play substitute?
Occasionally, it's very rare, but I do. Yeah.
Okay.
I've
So
done it
we
more in the past, but I don't as about now.
Okay. So but back then when you did, so like what when you filled that role, what kind of individual did you like would you want your firefighters coming to you? Did you lay out the expectations for the day?
Yeah, but so that's the nice thing about my role now, my position as a DO. I have that role now to a large degree. And some of that's the dynamic of my crew and the fact that the three of us on the truck have worked together for so long. And all of us, like I'm the most junior guy on my truck with 19 years. My captain and my driver are they're like a couple of years from retirement. So I already have a lot of that. If we have rookies, which we do, we have several rookies in my station right now. I already have that kind of leader, mentor kind of responsibility and role. So yeah, they already do that. And I do like that. I like being in that position where I get to share things the same way the guys shared stuff with me. But I don't have to ride seat for that. Like the authority that comes with riding seat is one thing. The leadership that comes from just being that kind of person, that can happen at any level, any rank. Any role, you can be a leader in your organization if everything falls in the right place and you manage it correctly and you're the right kind of person for that at that time.
Okay. All right. Your trucks, they only ride three?
Pretty much. Occasionally we'll have a fourth person if something gets shut down or we have, I mean, I don't know, rarity we get four on anything other than a particular engine that has to stay at four contractually, and then our heavy and hazmat, they're staffed with four. But
Okay.
yeah, pretty much everything else gets three. That's minimum is three, usually maximum is three.
All right. So, I don't want to say really having to do more with less because what does a first alarm box consist of?
I'll be honest, it has changed over the years, and we get a lot of companies jumping calls. We get people adding on, usually for good re like it's a good reason. Like people want to go to fires, and
Right.
that when you get granted to come, it's because somebody knows you're going to work when you get there. So I think we get four in one right now for a house, for a
Okay.
single family. We get four engines, one truck, one heavy or hazmat, one manpower. And we'll get two BCs for that as well. And then if there's a squad for us is a two-person quick response unit. They got all the fire tools and stuff, but it's just two dudes in a pickup truck that run med calls. If they're within a certain mile radius, they'll get pulled into the alarm as well. So that's a first alarm for a house. I think it shifts for apartments. It might be 3-2 or 4-2. You get two trucks on apartments. I think you still get the same engines. And then on commercials, I'm not sure what we get right now. The response model has changed a little bit, and again, with everybody just kind of asking to go, we usually end up with more than was initially dispatched by a unit or two. So
So let's just say truck 21 is going to be first arriving truck with three people on a working fire. What's the breakdown? Like, what is each role?
If we're first arriving on a single family or multifamily, the first due truck in my department is almost every single time going to be search. Barring, like, it would be a calling an audible to make them something else. Now, we don't have SOPs that say this. It's cultural, but it's so ingrained in our department. First engine is fire attack, second engine is water supply, third engine at that point it's whatever you need, usually a second line. First truck is search. If there's a second truck, they might also be search, or they might be helping open up, or they could be assigned to the roof. The heavy and the hazmat, there are four person manpower units. They can be assigned whatever. There are utility players, but they're very often treated more like a truck without ladders. That's just because they're already in a house with aerials, so they are really in tune with truck work. They can split 2 and 2. They can do inside and outside at the same time. So they're kind of our utility players that can do whatever. For me and my truck, my tractor driver is going to do outside truck work. So he's going to be working on throwing ladders, moving tools, dropping stuff, whatever needs to be done outside, setting up the aerial if it's got to go up, helping other drivers with their driver stuff. And then me and the officer, once we get there, I basically become a tailboard and I go with him. And if we're on search, our default is to split. So we work independently in coordination, but independently. So we could split on a floor. Occasionally we'll split floors if the visibility is really good and we just need to cover a lot of ground quickly, either for evac or checking just a larger house. My area has pretty big houses. We might split floors and he goes up, I go down, or vice versa. But quite often we end up on the same floor and we split and either leapfrog or go different directions depending on how the stairs come up or if whether we go into a window. Our last one was we don't get that many fires where I'm at, but our last one was a first due house fire. And when we did go in, we went through a window. And we actually went with three, all three of us. The tractor driver dressed out as well and came with us. And we all went through a window and all three split. So the only time that I'm with him is if conditions are so bad that I can't get away from him, like we're going to be pretty close to each other in the same area, or if we're going to the roof. That's pretty much it. We're together for those two situations and everything else. We're very independent because we've worked together for so long. I've known him for my entire career, and I've worked with him on that rig for 6 years straight. So we're pretty in tune with each other, and that happens with, I think, probably a lot of crews that end up like that in my department. There's a lot less talk when you get on scene, and a lot more independent but coordinated function with truck company operations.
And the thing, like to be able to do that, to split, to leapfrog rooms, you guys definitely had to have the practice in order to. It's not something you just, you know what I mean? Like it's not something if I come to your department as a floater and we get a fire, like you're gonna go, well, I don't know your capabilities. So pretty much what I'm saying is you guys have that training that's the game plan for you.
Yeah, it's either training or it comes through experience. At a previous house, I was at Station 19 for like 5 years, and 19 has the hazmat, so that manpower unit that has four on it. And when I was on the hazmat, every now and then I tried to stay on the Quint, which was a truck with a pump. It's a very ugly engine, really. But I tried not to be on the hazmat because it goes to too many gas leaks. But we would split 2 and 2. Usually the two tailboards would go one way and the officer and driver would go another. And just through time, we learned how to split. It just came naturally. We realized without talking about it, without an actual discussion around the kitchen table, we just figured out and understood that, hey, it's much faster. We can cover a lot more ground if we're not with each other, like side by side, holding hands or anything like that. Like, I got this room, you got that room. It wasn't an oriented search. We didn't keep somebody in the hallway. It was just like, hey, we know how this building is laid out. We know what we're doing. I got this one, you got that one. See you at the next one or whatever. And that's just how it went. There wasn't a lot of talk and discussion. That happened naturally and organically, but you are correct that it required something to make it happen. That something for us at that time was really just a lot of calls run together, a lot of working around each other, going to fires, going to other calls and stuff where you start to learn each other really, really well. And you just know when you get to this particular type of call, this is what's going to happen. That's just experience with each other. And that's kind of what I have with my current crew. I have a lot of experience with each other and a lot of discussion and talk. And we know how each other works and our little quirks and what this guy likes and doesn't like, what my officer likes and dislikes. And so, yeah, we're at the point now where we don't really have to discuss things. And also my officer listens to me. Like we're not equals, but there's a mutual respect. So if I say, hey, I think we should do this, pretty good chance he's going to agree with me or listen to me. If he hasn't made up his mind yet, we're probably going to do that. And if he says, no, I think we should do this, we have enough mutual respect and experience with each other now where I'm going to listen to him and go, well, I whatever it is, I probably missed something or he's got a different perspective and I'm just going to go with that because, and that takes a long time. I'm not a natural, like naturally I argue a lot. So it took us a while when we first got together as a crew for me to stop arguing with everything that one of the officers said and just do it and then come back later and figure out why did he want it done that way? And again, that's just running the calls. That's the experience. And then there might be some discussion about, hey, when you had me do this or you made this call, what was behind that? And now I see that as a parent. I've got kids that are that way. They want to argue with everything. And I'm like, I don't need argument right now. I need you to do this thing. And later after it's done, you can come back and ask me why I wanted it done this way. And I think that that's a pretty good analogy for the fire service and coming up underneath things. Like initially you might just have to do stuff and then figure out why that person is having you do it. And that's how you learn to work independently and coordinated, is you start to know each other's brains a little bit better. And that could happen through training. If you train with each other a bunch, if you don't run the calls and you don't have things, you train and you pre-plan some things and say, in this scenario, we're doing this. You come up with a game plan or an operation. This is what we're doing. Yeah, training does that. If you don't have the training, which I didn't at one of my previous houses, we didn't train search specifically with each other a lot, but we did search quite a bit. And so for us, we just kind of developed in that direction. So, yeah.
Okay. It's crazy to hear that with 19 years on, you are a junior on your truck compared to the two up front. That just goes to show you the level of experience and how it sounds like individuals stay there.
Stay where?
As far as like no one, like as soon as you join the cab, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but many people don't leave to go to another organization.
Many people don't leave, but many people do. And I think that's not unique to the cab. I think everybody has a retention issue currently with the past, I don't know, 5+ years of hires. It's a different mindset about a job, a career, an occupation. That's a little different. When I came on, I tested with 700 people. I took the written test with 700 people, and there were 3 days in a row of that. So probably over 2,000 people took the written test. And of those, they hired 30 in the initial hiring. My initial recruit class was 30 of us. And then they hired another 30 a couple months later and another 30 after that. So they hired quite a few out of that 2,000, but they didn't hire everybody that tested. Now, a lot of departments are having to keep hiring open year round, gather enough recruits or enough applicants to hold a process, and then hope that they can hire, you know, an entire recruit class out of that. And a lot of people now are, the recruit classes are looking like 20 people. And out of those, you might get 15, 10 actually graduate. And then out of those, some organizations might lose half of those to another department that starts paying a little more or has something that somebody wants. And that's a really tough thing. It's not unique to my department or any other around. It's a struggle all over the place for a lot of departments. How do you recruit and how do you retain? So yeah, while I have 19 years, I'm in it for the long haul. I've wanted to do this for a long time. It's all I've wanted to do. I've never wanted to ditch this and go with a different job. But not everybody is that way. Some people come into it later in the years and they come into it after several career changes, or they get started right out of the gate early on as a young kid and find that, you know, once their life changes a little bit, they got other things that are a priority and they move on out of the fire service or to another department that takes care of them or their family or whatever their needs and wants are better than the one that they're at. So DeKalb's not unique. We lose enough people that it makes a difference. Okay. So I have 19 years. The two other guys on the truck with me have getting close to 30 years. But we've got a very young department with, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10 years in there. A lot of our department is made up of those 5 to 10 year guys. Okay. And I'm hoping they stay. Like, I really like, they're not disposable. They're valuable members of the department, and every organization hopefully is hiring valuable members that you want to keep. If you're hiring people and you don't care that they leave after a couple of years, you probably, it's not going to work out in the long run. So yeah, those are good people that are leaving, but we do lose them, especially the younger ones who have only been on for, you know, 5 years, 10 years at the most.
Right. Okay. I wanted to ask you this top, we know we talked about this before recording, but slow stations and the bad rap that they get. You know, I told you earlier that there are some slow stations or retirement homes, whatever you want to call them, where individuals willingly go there to do less. We all know that. But there are situations where individuals get put at that station, and whether it's a brand new station or whatever, just like, to me, you can only control so much. I can't control the call volume in a station's area. Like, nobody can. It all depends on the geographical area. With you being at you said a slower house compared to what the DeKalb's known for, what's your mindset? What's your take on slow stations?
I think that they have, it's mixed. It's mixed. I love where I'm at because of the crew that I'm at. If I didn't have my crew, it would be very difficult to deal with the lack of call volume, because you have to replace the call volume with something else to keep you going. Mm-hmm. I'm not the kind of person that can go to a place and just sit and do nothing. I do sit, and there are days where I just want to do nothing, and that the station I'm at affords me that opportunity most of the time. But we also, my station trains a lot. And so that's how we replace that. Instead of having all of that downtime where you're doing nothing and you're bored and the younger guys can't grow, they're not running the calls, you have to replace that with training. It's that simple. You have to. There's not a choice. If you're at a slow house and you're not doing stuff to make yourself or the station better, then you're going to wither, and it's all of your skills are going to disappear. But when the call does happen, you're still going to be expected to perform at the level of the guys who are down south running all the calls. That's the problem. Is you can go to the north side station or in your area, whatever part of your department that's in, you can go to the slow station, but when a fire comes out, you're still expected to perform with busy station skills. That standard is still there. For me, it is. Your organization may not hold you to that standard, but I hold myself to that standard, and our crew holds itself. And I hold the people around me in the other slow stations, I hold them to that standard. When they get on scene, I expect them to do their job as well as I'm doing mine. And that's my hope anyways. Realistically, I know that there are some lower performers and there are some higher performers, and you can have low performers even at busy houses, and you can have high performers at slow ones. It's diverse, it's mixed. But if you're at a slow house and you're not replacing the call volume with something else, it's a recipe for disaster eventually. I mean, that's I don't like that at all. I would go crazy. So like for instance, yesterday, we actually invited another company over, and we had two companies at our house at one time, and we threw ladders. We just did ladder training, ground ladders. It's not sexy or cool or really that interesting to most people. Ground ladders are largely boring and they suck. They hurt. They're painful. They're big. They're heavy. They're annoying. They're not a fun skill. They're not a cool skill. It's not like getting on a roof and cut and stuff. It's not like forcing doors even. As far as truck work goes, ground ladders is like the sucky part of truck work for most people. And I recognize that. But it's also one of the two things that are going to make you look the dumbest on a fire scene. Is if you can't throw a ladder when you need to, and you can't force a door when you need to, all eyes are on you. And everything can hinge in that. Like you drop a ground ladder, everybody sees it, but even worse, it may be the thing that kept somebody from getting in or out of that particular window. So it matters greatly. And so that's what we did yesterday. We don't necessarily do, you know, 4 hours of ground ladders every day, but most days we're doing something. We're out in the territory. If we're going to the grocery store, we're still looking at things that are getting built in our territory. Every time we go somewhere, we're doing stuff, and we do a fair amount of pre-planning, pre-fire planning, and walking through, because we have so many large buildings, have high rises, have huge apartment monstrosities. You could walk through buildings every day and never run out of buildings in my territory. There's just that much. And it's not a huge territory. It's just that much, that many businesses, that much new stuff to cover, and that much information to know about our territory, that if you came and sat down and looking around at my territory, you look up, you can't see out, you just look up. If you walked into that house and sat down after driving past all of those buildings, I would have a hard time. Like, I don't understand that. That would make me extremely nervous to be in that area and have zero intel about any of this stuff around me.
Yeah.
So I have to do things. Not everybody's that way.
Right.
And that is where you get that. I mean, some people are, I'm naturally lazy just from a task point of view. Like, I'm a pretty low energy person, but my brain is always moving. So I can't turn that off. So I have to be doing something. Mm-hmm. And there are some people that they don't have that. They can go somewhere and they can just sit and watch TV or YouTube or something all day and not even think about the department around them or the rig outside or any of that stuff. That's another thing that we do to keep busy. It's like I'm always working. Either we're working on something around the house, like they call it A-shift arts and crafts. Like we're always fixing something, breaking something. Like we're always doing something. Most of the time to stay busy.
Okay.
And I think that's how you deal with a slow house. I think you just continue. You either make yourself better or you make the station better as often as you can.
Okay. This next topic, please feel free if you don't want to discuss it. I am 100% okay with it, but it is a realization. It is a part of the job that I think many lose sight of. Here recently, you guys unfortunately lost a firefighter off of the rescue. I think it was Master Firefighter Fant, if I got that right. Hopefully I didn't butcher that.
Fant, Preston Fant.
Preston Fant. Whenever, so I subscribe to the secret list. So like Billy G sends out, hey, an injury or line of duty death, you read it and you're like, damn. And then like when a NOSH report comes out, hopefully like we all read it, but you read it and then like you figure out, like, damn, this is what I don't want to repeat. I bring this up because the cab is very busy. Certain areas of the cab, very busy. A lot of fire duty, lots of runs, lots of calls. But for the ones who think this will never happen where I work, I know all, I can name all of our people that we have by their first name, things like that. Like it's a reality of the job that I think very many don't take seriously. The fact that you can leave, I can like I go and shift tomorrow. I can leave tomorrow and may not come back. You know what I mean? Due to the nature of the job. So how important is it for others to take what we do seriously? Being seeing the experiences that you guys have recently gone through.
I don't think too many people really dwell on the I could go to work and not come home thing. I think everybody understands that. We may not think about it that much, but I don't think it's something that has to be thought about continuously. It does catch you off guard. Like Preston's death caught everybody off guard. I mean, that dude's such a stellar fireman that it's hard to believe that something like that could happen to somebody like that. And I still don't know details, and I'm not trying to know details until stuff, settles out about what happened and all that stuff. But it happens, and there are plenty of stellar firemen. I mean, Irmo had one a couple of years ago in South Carolina. Like, it happens to good firemen. I think it's understood. I don't think we have to put a lot of extra emphasis on the fact that good firemen can get hurt. So, like, you should take your job seriously. I think it's more useful to remind people that, hey, our citizens get hurt. We know firemen get hurt. We have no shortage of reminders that firemen die in the line of duty, and good ones too. No shortage of reminders. I mean, everybody from starting at before 9/11, but especially coming out of 9/11, the number of good firemen that were lost, like notable firemen in an organization with 10,000 firemen, you had standouts. It's hard to be a standout in something that big, but your Andrew Fredericks, your Patty Browns, those guys, the legends of that organization, they still were taken out, and it does happen. Everybody knows that. I think what we lose sight of sometimes is that we lose a ton of citizens every year in fires. That's the seriousness that I think that a lot of departments don't really latch onto, is they don't treat it like that's their family that they're taking care of. They're able to separate that and say, no, this is just some stranger. And I don't like that. I think it's gotten better in the last 5+ years. It's gotten a lot better with a lot of the conferences and the mindset that's put out there. But I don't think that we need more emphasis on the fact that firemen can get hurt and killed, even good ones. I think we just need a continued understanding of that, along with the fact that, hey, we are here for a reason. We're here for the citizens. Because if we're not going to take care of them, then they don't need us. We're totally unnecessary to them if we're not going to take care of them as if they're our family, because they can do that for themselves. If we're going to show up and stand outside and watch a building burn down, they can do that. And so, yeah, I think that's a better focus, is to shift that, to understand, yeah, good guys get hurt, and you need to train. But if you are in the business of taking care of citizens, you will also take care of your own guys. You will also take care of yourself. If you are preparing to take care of your family, then you are also by default taking care of yourself. You're doing all of those things. If you are being a better fireman, you're training, you and your people are working on those skills and those strategies and tactics and everything that's going to make you better on the fire ground for the citizens, it naturally makes you better for each other and for yourselves. It's not possible for it to not carry over onto the other stuff. They're inseparable. It is possible to look out for yourself and leave the citizens behind. That is entirely possible. If we over-focus on self-rescue and RIT and firefighter survival at the expense of search and other sub and just simple fire attack, like just simply being good at stretching and flowing, if you leave those things behind and focus on the survival skills, you are more likely probably, I would estimate, to have to use those survival skills. And you are also in the process, you're going to leave behind the citizens. So that's my perspective on it, I guess.
No, love the perspective. And you could tell there's a shift because, man, give a couple years ago, that's where the fire service was. That's where we were at, like firefighter safety. We you know, incident command or whoever pulls up to a structure, we're playing God, like, if anyone's in there, we're writing them off, you know what I mean? And now I've seen that shift where conferences are hitting search hard, survivability profiling, things of that nature. So I 100% agree with you on that. I want to see where I want to take this next. I'm going to ask you this one. Wellness and truly being there for one another. You've been on for a decent amount of time where I think me and you were on, we've been on where it was the mentality of, hey kid, don't ask questions unless, spoken to. And, oh, hey, did that call affect you? Hey, well, suck it up. You know, we got to get ready for the next one. But now seeing the shift of like, having those conversations like, hey, this call really sucked. I just want to talk to somebody. What's your take on wellness and the brotherhood of the fire service?
I don't know. I don't know when it really came up and started to become an actual topic on its own. I'm sure it's been a topic all along the way. I mean, I'm a post 9/11 fireman, so I'm sure coming out of 9/11 and the hardship that everybody that was there and the guys that weren't there for that had probably a lot of those discussions. I don't know how much of that spilled over into the fire service at large, but I'm sure in that community around New York, it was probably pretty big. So when I came on in 2006, yeah, it wasn't necessarily a big push, but even at the beginning, my organization brought us in and had a day before we were ever, I don't even, it might've been before we even started the fire academy. They brought us in and had us bring our significant others, your girlfriends, boyfriends, wives, husbands, whatever, had you bring your person with you. And they sat down and talked about, hey, this is what life is like. This is a little bit of a glimpse of the expectation of like, this is what you guys might go through. And some of that, that deals with some mental health and some relationship stuff and things like that. So there was a bit of that in my department. And I know along the way, I can't think of a whole lot of like really bad calls I had early on, especially before I had kids. But I remember having a day when I was younger. I was a relief driver at an engine company. And I probably had like, I don't know, six, 7 years on, something like that. Maybe less than that, but anyways, I was a relief driver. So I wasn't the assigned driver. I wasn't a, acting officer or anything like that, but I just had it was one of those days where we had the very first call of the day was we relieved somebody on a fire and dug, somebody out of the ashes. And then the next call that we had was, a grandma that hung herself in a stairwell of her apartments and grandson found her. And then after that, we had I think that was the day we had a 5-year-old drown in a pool. and like all three of those by, I don't know, lunchtime, roughly, somewhere around there. And I made a post on Facebook. My officer was off that day, so he wasn't at the house, but he saw my post, and all I said was just like, today sucks. And he knew that something was up. And so he texted me. I was like, hey, what's up, man? And I appreciated that. Like, that was just somebody checking in because he knew that, like, it's just taking care of your people. If you know your guys, you can usually tell when that day is a bad day. You might not know long term, like chronic stuff building up. If you're not really aware of what's going on in their life, a lot of people can hide stuff and cover stuff. But that guy looked out for me. He made sure that I was doing okay. And that was just a bad day. It wasn't like a long-term problem or anything. So I don't know that it's all brand new, but I think a lot of it is common sense and straightforward. Just take care of your, like, look out for your guys. Be nice to people. Pay attention to people. Don't be a dick unless you really have to. I'm naturally that way. It's hard for me not to be, but yeah, I don't even remember what the question was anymore.
No,
Sorry.
you're good. You're good. You're good. We'll leave it at that because everything you said 100% makes sense. I think those are the small things. Just the biggest thing is just like you mentioned two things. Be nice. Just don't be a dick. Like, but you know, firemen like to do the like. There's a time and a place for the joking, and if you got to be able to know that person to know is this a time or is this not time.
And I get it wrong a lot. I have to apologize sometimes when I misjudge that time, or I just don't hold back when I should, and I let my natural butthole come out. I get it wrong. Not that long ago, I had to apologize to one of my rookies because in the group text, I was joking, but it didn't come across as joking, and it rubbed in the wrong way. He made it very clear right away. And then the next time I saw him in person, I apologized. It's just I made a wrong choice on how I handled the joking part of it, and it wasn't a joke to him. And okay, cool, I stepped over the line. It happens. I think a big one is just being open to talking to each other. That takes trust, though. If guys don't trust each other, if they don't trust the people around them, a lot of times it's difficult to get into that position where you are comfortable enough saying the things that you need to say, either to another person or just to any person. If you got stuff going on and you need to talk about it, it can be very difficult to have enough trust in whoever it is around you to even open up about it. You might think that you might be embarrassed, or you might be afraid that that's going to get out and you don't know how it's going to be handled in the department at large. You know, what kind of effect it's going to have on people. I'm pretty open about stuff. I've had anxiety attacks before, and I've talked about it and I've explained it to people, and hopefully that helps other people understand that, like, this can be a thing. It can be a normal thing. Like, I've had a 3-day anxiety attack before. It sucked. And I called that list of mentors. There's a guy on it that I called immediately. That's my guy. I knew who to call when I was having this thing going on. If I didn't have a list of mentors to refer to, people that I knew I could lean on, it would have been big. Like, I could call my crew, I could talk to my officers, but like, they're not the guys for that thing. That time when I was having a really rough go of it for a few days, I called one particular person. But coming out of it, I'm willing to talk to anybody and everybody about it. I now have a new perspective on that I didn't have before. When we run anxiety calls and stuff like that, I got a different kind of understanding. And being open about it has meant that other people have then talked to me about it. And so, you know, so one of the guys that I opened up to about it, his son had anxiety. And he put his son on the phone with me during one of those anxiety attacks or periods. And if I hadn't done that, his son wouldn't have anybody to talk to about it in that particular moment. So I think that's a big thing, is if you treat people the right way, you don't have to hold their hand and coddle them. But if you treat people with respect and dignity, that also means that you can still correct them. You can, like, that's honestly part of respecting somebody and caring about them, is if they're screwing up, you fix it. Doesn't mean you ignore problems or you let stuff go, but it does mean that you treat them like a person, like a member of the team. And if you do that, I think people are more likely to present their problems to the appropriate person that they think can help them. If you don't do that, then that person may not feel like they have anybody at all during that moment when they need somebody, and they're just going to keep it held in. So I've had those people along the way. It's been huge for me. I've had people I could call and talk to when I really needed to, or people that called me when they saw that I needed that. I think that's really what's, if you just connect to people, eventually those people that need help, if they have the connection, it opens the door a lot easier for them to reach out when they need it. Yeah.
Right. No, I'm good with it. 100%. I always like to ask the guests this last question. Where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it all up?
I imagine I'll go back south. I don't know if I'll go back all the way to where I was before my current assignment, where I was running, 15 calls a shift. But I'd like to get back to going to more fires. That means running more med calls. That's fine. I don't know if I want to do it for the next 9 years or however long I got. But when my guys retire, when my tractor and my tractor driver and officer retire, there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to want to go somewhere else and link up with other guys with similar mindset and experience and a drive to do things and be good at their job. I'm not saying that somebody won't come and replace them at my house, but it's not as likely that I'm going to end up with that kind of crew and dynamic like what I have right now. So I think that's what I'd probably try to look for, is a place where I can find that again, with other guys who have a similar, where I fit in. That's also a struggle for me. I don't have the kind of personality that fits in everywhere. And so that's always been a challenge for me, is to find a home where my personality is a good fit. You can't just shove any square peg in any round hole. Right now, I'm at an island for misfit toys. It's perfect. Like, all of us are up there. Some of us against our will, some of us because it's just time for a change. But nobody, almost nobody's up there because they requested to go there because it's such an awesome place to be. I think it's a great house and we got a lot going for us, but it's slow and people don't request to go there. So pretty good chance when it all settles out, I'll probably be back down south, hopefully on a truck company if I can stay with a truck, or at least in a double house, where there is a truck and I can keep those skills fresh. That's still where I'd like to be, where I enjoy things. But yeah, that's probably about it. I don't really see promotion. I don't see company officer in the near future. I just don't think that there's, the way that my organization is currently, I like the way it was when I came in. Company officers had a lot more autonomy, a lot more control, a lot more say so in what happened within the walls of their house. I don't think that they have that as much, or in some cases at all. And instead, they're saddled with all of the responsibility when stuff goes wrong, but none of the autonomy and control over making stuff the way that they want to make it in the meantime. And I'm not interested in that. I have currently, as a DO, I have input on the things that are important to me in the department, and influence over the things that I want to be involved in. And I think that's pretty good. And I'm a Tillerman, man. Like, it's hard. It's so hard to beat that. I can't imagine like leaving that behind and never being able to do it again. Like you just promote and then like you're done driving, especially that tiller box, man. That tiller cab is the place. So
Okay.
that'd be a tough one to leave behind. I don't know. Who knows though? I've never seen the urge to move or change coming. It's always just kind of happened. You know, every move or change or adaptation or anything that I've ever been through, they really have not come in a planned fashion. So at some point, maybe that changes. Maybe I do want to promote. Maybe I do see an opportunity that I want to take. But right now, I don't see that.
Okay. I really love the part where you hit on about your personality not matching everybody else's and trying to find a place that fits you and that gets you. Because I mean, I can tell you personally, I am tired of hearing individuals tell me that I need to socialize with certain groups or certain parts of the department, and it's like, no. Like there are, you know, I equate the fire service to high school. You have your jocks, you have your jokesters, you have your pranksters, you have your followers, and you have your leaders. Like, I don't want to be that person that's hanging around the so-called jock because they're Mr. Popular and become one of their lackeys or their followers. Like, that's not me. I would rather just be alone, talking to myself, as far as like just doing me. Like, I don't like when someone says, hey, you need to do this. I don't have to do anything. If somebody has something they want to ask me, or we have something we want to talk about, I'll talk. But don't tell me I have to be with this certain group, or it can look like whatever the hell it looks like. But like I just love how you put that together, because I feel like too, there's like a peer pressure that we have to be around all these people, and we have to like put them on a pedestal, and it's like, fuck that. Like, that's just not me. That's not how
Yeah,
I do it.
I'm naturally abrasive, and I've worked on it my whole career. I have natural know-it-all tendencies, and that leads into that abrasiveness. It's very difficult for me to turn that off. Even when I was a rookie and I was absolutely wrong about a bunch of stuff, I was convinced that I was right and that I knew more. And it's difficult for me. Like I know that about myself now, and occasionally it spills over and somebody's got to say, hey, you're doing it again. But yeah, so that's one of my personality traits, one of the negatives that drives people away. And also over the years, I think I've matured a lot, where in the beginning, when I started to develop kind of a mindset and how I thought the fire service should be, and somebody else did not share that perspective, I did not understand them at all, and I did not know how to communicate with a person like that. So if you had a different perspective, a different mindset, and it didn't look like mine, we were gonna not get along at all. I connected the personal, it became personal to me basically, and I didn't know how to turn that off, and I didn't know how to interact with people outside of that, where we don't agree on, tactics and, how things should go on the fire ground or what the priorities are, or whatever the mindset stuff is that spills into all of those things. If we didn't agree on that, dude, we just weren't going to see eye to eye on anything back then.
Right.
And now I'm older, more mature. I see how people have different perspectives and we can disagree. And now I'm pretty good at like not making it personal for myself. If somebody else makes it personal, I can't change that. But I try not to take it personally when other it doesn't hurt my feelings now if you have a difference of opinion or perspective. It would have been offensive to me back then. I would have said basically, you don't belong here. And that's how I would have treated that person. And I pushed a lot of people away and I established a reputation very early on for how I talked and acted and things like that. And it's taken the rest of my career to try and undo a lot of that damage that I did. And so that leads into like me finding a home. I'm still that person underneath. It takes a lot of work for me to not let that come out. And so finding a place where I fit in with the established culture of that crew can be very difficult. And I'm sure plenty of people share that experience. That's not to say that the crew is bad. It's entirely just, it's a me thing. I recognize that. I've been at crews that were freaking phenomenal, and it still wasn't, I didn't fit. As much as I tried, as hard as I worked, in fact, the harder I tried, the worse it was. It was like I was trying too hard to fit. So yeah, hopefully other people, if you identify with that, any of the listeners that are listening, if they identify with that, like that's a pretty, I imagine that's pretty normal. You know, I'm not autistic, but I'm a carrier. I can make them. I've got one here at the house, but I imagine I've got some of those traits that rub people the wrong way. I see some of the things that my kid does and says, and I'm like, oh, that's, you got that from me. I gave you that. And so, yeah, I imagine there's probably a lot of people in the fire service that have some of those same struggles. And hopefully that doesn't get in my way too much down the road. But yeah, that's something I do think about and I worry about in the next, I don't know, few years when I do potentially find a new home. What is that home going to be? If I had to move right now, I don't know where I would fit anywhere else than other than where I'm at right now. Mm-hmm. Like even if there was an opening, I don't know of a crew where I could just jump right in and be like, yeah, this is my new home. It would be tough for me to find that at first. So that is definitely one of those things down the road that I'm, you know, I'll be looking at.
Okay. All right. With that, William, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you being very open. We discussed a lot of things, you know, a lot of things that firemen tend to not want to share and things, but I just want to say thank you for accepting the invite, for coming on. I also want to thank Clay. I did look it up. It was Clay. I just want to make sure. Clay's been really awesome and instrumental in allowing me to contact individuals who definitely have that mindset. So Clay, I want to say shout out to you again. Thank you. And William, thank you for accepting the phone call and coming on to talk shop. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.